many good things coming up in the next few moments as we make our weekly visit with our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Mr. Fleming.
Hey, what's up, Campbell?
I am just here living the dream, living large, living out loud. Living is what I'm doing.
I hear you. I think I need a catch line. I've been working on some.
Yeah, well, do you have some possibilities for us?
Yeah. I was mulling in the monument earlier today that I could say something a little edgy, like Colin Fleming, hooking up with fun and hooking up with intelligence.
Ooh.
But then that sounded kind of like threesome-y, so then I was thinking maybe Colin Fleming, let's get smarter. But that's kind of condescending, so I'm still working on it. Although, right. For now, let's go with the temporary, let's get smarter and autumnal.
I like that. Before we get to the autumnal talk, though, it sounds like you maybe saved a guy's life in the monument. What happened?
Oh, no. I was in there today, and there was a couple, and the guy was a little bit older. And I passed him like 3 or 4 times. He was sitting there about 2/3 of the way up, and he wasn't in dire need or anything like that, but he wasn't moving. And then one time I was coming back down, I asked if they needed anything, and his wife asked if I had any water, and I said no, but I would go down and tell the park rangers, and also at the same time get the park rangers back on my side because they've been reprimanding me. Of late, there have been some anonymous complainers, people offended by me politely asking if they would move aside. And when I went to the monument yesterday, it was actually sufficiently hot enough here in Boston that it was closed because of the heat index. It's like a law, it has to be closed when it reaches a certain point. And I come in and the park ranger and I say, oh, is it closed to confirm this? And she says, yeah, you'll have to go outside and run up and down the little stairs like 300 times. Huh, you're on to me, my friend.
Wow. Well, so I won't ask, and you don't need to tell, if you did this out of a sense of altruism, helping your fellow man, or just to get this guy out of your way.
It was my last climb, and I should add, in case God is recording this for my CV for heaven, I finished the climb. I said, can I just finish my climb, and then I'll go down and get you some water. So I'll come clean on that. But I do a lot of the things that I do that are really good and charitable and decent because I also do not want to deal with my conscience later. I'm a bit of a Raskolnikov that way, although it ends up working out, and I have a pretty good moral batting average, I think. And they were nice because she said to me, like, is this your workout? That's crazy. And the monument, it's sort of a record of our life cycle, I feel like, because the monument doesn't change. And you go in there, and I feel like if I didn't do this every day, I could reach the point where I can't do it, and it beats me. It's like the mountain, except it's a monument. So there was a lot going on in my addled brain at the moment.
Oh, by the way, did you get your downtown shirt yet?
I have, and I was about to pop it on.
Yeah.
So I could be properly attired before I came on. And I've just been writing, and I tripped over like 4 things in here, and I almost choked on the peppermint I was sucking on.
Oh,
and I thought, okay, you don't need to Heimlich yourself before you go on Kimball. Find it for the next show, wear it for that, thank him properly, and tell him that it's a great fit, and you're not soiling it in the monument, which I'm not going to do. And Emma said, Kimball's on to you, don't soil it. I said, okay, I won't. Can we all stop saying soil is a verb?
You do what you need to do with it. It's yours. You wear it well. All right, let's talk autumnal art, and let's begin with, a little Hammer Films trip into the world of mythology from 1964.
True, and Hammer didn't often go to the mythological well. It was a departure for Hammer, and you had mentioned with this film, The Gorgon, that you had not seen it in a while, and that made me think, doesn't really matter, because with a number of these Hammer films, especially when you get into the second part of the cycle, so we're after Horror of Dracula in the late 1950s and all of that, which rebooted horror. It revitalized the genre after the Universal films in the 1930s that petered out primarily in the 1940s, and there was Creature from the Black Lagoon that lingered on into the 50s, but there is a prevailing sameness with the Hammer films of the early 1960s, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. The Gorgon is the Medusa-like character, the Hydra, and what's notable about this film is directed by Terence Fisher, and he helmed stuff like Horror of Dracula, which you could argue is maybe the best horror movie ever made, the best color horror movie ever made. And he's interesting to me because he didn't really have a style as a director. His style was the atmosphere of his film. His counterpart would be someone like Roy William Neal, who oversaw the Sherlock Holmes films with Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce, and he also did a Universal picture, Frankenstein meets the Wolfman. But right from the beginning of The Gorgon, you're in this Germany of 1910, which easily could be upstate New York or New England or somewhere that we just think of as quintessentially fall-like. And the leaves are swirling on the ground, they're blowing through. And it doesn't even really matter what the plot's going to be. You have these murders that are not being investigated because people essentially know that we don't really want to muck about too much with this. We're going to find out there's a Gorgon on the loose. And nobody wants to contend with that, right? It's an uphill battle. So they let it go as long as they can. And you have a great cast because these films, these Hammer films, they're all based around this ambiance where you have this hangout factor with Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, and they are the Mantle Maris. They are the Gretzky Coffee, Jordan Pippen of the Hammer lineup. You're always going to get something great with them, even if it's low-key great. And I would say that this is pretty low-key great. It's not going to terrify you, but it is going to make you reach for the Reese's Peanut Butter Cups pretty hard.
And there's always, in those films, too, an actress that you see and you go, I know her. I've seen her in other things, and she's great in this as the poor beleaguered woman. Who is it? I can't remember who it is in The Gorgon.
You have Barbara Shelley in it.
Ah, yes, that's right. Yes.
She's a Hammer mainstay.
Yes.
And you do. You get the regular retinue of these characters, and I like that. I like seeing these reoccurring faces. These were English films, and the English were past masters of character acting. And you're seeing that at the time, in the 1960s, less and less. In America, you're seeing it more and more on television. We have all of those faces, right? It's like, hey, I know you from Bonanza, and I know you from Wanted Dead or Alive, and you were on Twilight Zone and Outer Limits. It's still on the big screen in England, and primarily, I think, thanks to the Hammer melange, these characters that we come to know. We often don't even know their names. We just recognize, like, yeah, you're that inn caretaker, and I don't know about you, sextant over there. You're a little distrustful, and it enhances, I feel, our enjoyment with these pictures.
All right, we're talking about autumnal works of art. Let's move from film to literature, and a great piece of science fiction, The Edge of Running Water. William Sloan takes us to a remote Maine farmhouse for mysteries galore.
He does, and it's a hodgepodge of style where it's horror, it's sci-fi, it's a philosophical treatise, it's a cautionary tale against probing too much into science, and also, fascinatingly, it's a mystery. It's specifically a locked room mystery, or if one prefers, a locked device mystery, where you have this Professor Richard, he's traveling to this fictitious Maine town of Barsham Harbor. Sounds a little bit like Bangor. I wonder if that's where William Sloan got the idea for that phonetical sensibility. And his buddy, who is older than he is his mentor, his former mentor. And his wife died. And this guy, Richard, he used to be in love with the woman who died, who married this professor, Julian Blair. And Julian Blair is doing something with physics that is aiming to rekindle conversation with his late love. And he has his niece, who this guy, Richard, also had a thing for, but she was young and now she's the right age, even though she's 15, 20 years his junior. And there's a meddlesome medium who is there in case Dr. Richard Blair's machine in this room does not work in terms of getting access to the dead. And it's highly atmospheric. Again, that's what you want with fall-centric works. And William Sloan is a fascinating character to me. He wrote one of the best novels I've ever read that I reread every year. And we talked about it once on this show that came out in 1937, 2 years before this particular book. And he only wrote the two novels. And for a long time, I knew that he had written a short story. And I hunted like mad for this short story because I had to see this. This man only left three works. He was an academic. He worked at Princeton. He started the press. Well, I came to the short story eventually, and it wasn't very good. So everything he had went into these two novels, which are both told first person. And they're very convivial that way. And again, you're pulled in. The descriptions, it's perfect prose and stretches. It's prose that Fitzgerald of Tender is the Night would aspire to, and if he reached that mantle, would be well pleased with himself. And there's just really no book, save maybe that other book from 1937, that's like this one. And again, just set in New England, perfect for when it's cool outside, you're having the hot chocolate.
And this one, along with To Walk the Night, were both reissued, if I remember right, in the collection that had a foreword from our owner, Stephen King.
Yeah, Stephen King, he wrote the introduction for that volume. It's interesting to me because he's not willing to say things like how good this guy is at writing. This guy could write circles around just about anyone I can name. He's a better writer than Faulkner. He's a better writer than Steinbeck. And King is like, he's prevaricating and saying, oh, I can't. No, those were the really deep writers. It's like, just go there, man. You don't need everyone else to say it for you to be able to say it, too. It is obvious that this man is a prose virtuoso. I take this book with me whenever I go to the hospital for the emergency room when I have something wrong with me because it calms me. I study these two books, especially the 1937 one, but this is pretty close as like the one's an A+ and the other is a solid 95. And yeah, you get them in one handy book. You'd think they could have stuck in the short story that I went on this odyssey for. But no, you can find that on eBay if you look.
Let's move to the world of music and Charlie Parker's take on a classic Vernon Duke song, Autumn in New York.
Autumn in New York was written, not surprisingly, of course, because this is the best region for fall in Connecticut in the mid-1930s. And Norman Granz wanted Parker to do this. He wanted to help Parker do what Parker had wanted to do for a long time, and that was record within a setting of string. And we might think, oh, what's the big deal about that? Why wouldn't a jazz musician do that? Well, jazz musicians did not do that. And Parker was actually seen as a sellout at the time for doing this. It wasn't his own songs that he was recording. These were standards. And the recordings, the records he made from several sessions between 1949 and 1952, this song being from 1952, January, they were his biggest sellers, not the driving bop, the modernism, the ruthless modernism he made with the likes of Dizzy Gillespie in the mid-1940s. And when you listen to this song, I think Henry Mancini had it in mind, to be honest with you, when he wrote the theme for Newhart. Because it has that kind of vibe, you're going under covered wagon type of deal. And it's the tone of Parker's alto sax that is this ladling of citron, this butteriness. It's all pure caramelized tone that mimics, in my mind, is the euphonic version of that dappled, burnished sunlight that we get in autumn, especially in New England, the way the light falls on the canvas of our particular terra firma. And this is the sound of that in what is really a vanguard recording, although at the time, people were like, okay, he's going for the hits. You look back on it now, it's like, yeah, he was a forerunner. Other people fell in line with what Parker was doing. Clifford Brown with string. Stan Getz recorded a strings-based album in the early 1960s, and this was really a major foray, major moment for Charlie Parker.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Let's move to the canvas and a beautiful work of art that Vincent van Gogh painted, I think, less than a year before he died while he was in an asylum, The Mulberry Tree in Autumn.
Yeah, he's not long for the world at this point, and he had, like you said, less than a year left to go. He's at the asylum, which is remarkable with this painting because it doesn't seem like it's from civilization in some way. There is a box, maybe for collecting picked apples, I don't know, leaning up against the tree, which is this wonderful touch that you can easily miss, that is this intersection of a sort of divinity and the earthly. If we think of a painting like Van Gogh's Starry Night, and you have the heavens, and it's all about the celestial region, but that cypress tree, it goes up higher than a cypress tree ought to. It pierces the heavens. It creates the intersection of our Quixotian world and an infinite world. And that is what art really does. And here you have this mulberry tree popping with these impostos, baubles of impostos. In ball four, Jim Bowden says something about, like, they wanted to go to MoMA to see if the Van Gogh paintings had dried yet. This is a kind of painting that he would be talking about because its three-dimensionality comes right off of the canvas. And this tree is this nuclear atomic creation, this tree beyond trees. It feels like it's creating this kinetic charged energy in the air, not just in the air in the planar field that it occupies, but right in front of you when you look at it. It is all of the concomitant power of autumn, the colors reduced, boiled into this one particular bit of glorious shrubbery.
I love autumn so much, and so I'm disappointed in myself that I had never read John Clare's Autumn until you told me we'd be talking about it. And I hope you'll read it because, God, it's great.
It is great, and I love John Clare. He's my favorite poet. He was a contemporary for a while of the much more famous John Keats, who 200 years ago at this time was having his great year of the odes before he died not long after. And he was tremendously poor, John Clare. And we've talked about him before. He had to write on the back of bark. He was ushered into London society as the peasant poet. Like, okay, idiot. You're uneducated, but you can kind of do these poems. It was condescending, but he had this run where he was somewhat well-known. And when I was looking up this poem the other day to reread it, I happened to see some comments by people really ripping on it, saying he got it all wrong. And I think what he did is beyond brilliant. It's only three stanzas. The thistle down's flying, so the winds are all still. On the green grass now lying, now mounting the hill. The spring from the fountain now boils like a pot. Through stones past the counting, it bubbles red hot. The ground parched and cracked is like overbaked bread. The green sward all racked is, fence dried up and dead. The fallow fields glitter like some water indeed. And gossamers twitter, flung from weed unto weed. Hilltops like hot iron glitter bright in the sun. And the rivers were eyeing, burned to gold as they run. Burning hot is the ground, liquid gold is the air. Whoever looks round sees eternity here. Again, you have the earth. We are ensconced in the intense coloration of the earth. Fall is a time of great chaos. It's a time of things becoming undone, not extending. The air, again, is charged. And what he is writing about here, people say, oh, that sounds more like summer. No, it doesn't.
No.
He's talking about the energy of the colors, not the temperature, not what's going on with, oh, I'm sweaty out there today. So when he says the ground parched and cracked is like overbaked bread, you look at the ground in fall, it's because the moisture has been pulled out of it. It's not like it is in spring. It's not like it is in summer. Everything has that trending to brittleness, like leaves themselves in the lime. And the rivers were eyeing, burned to gold as they run.
Mm.
People think, how is that? It's because the water is gone from these pools, from the vernal springs. Up is coming the russet ground, the earth. These colors, these intense colorations are asserting themselves. He's saying that the river is no longer made of the fluvial. It's not water anymore. The colors are the river. And it's exactly what Van Gogh painted. It's the posy version of the post-impressionist version, and it's the dryadic version of what we're getting with the Gorgon and the Medusa has that tangling of colors and the bewitchedness. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful poem that, again, knits up the transcendent with the here I am wandering about in October. Doesn't it smell nice out? Let's get some s'mores.
And we were talking about this yesterday. I love autumn, and I know a lot of people love September. That's not autumn. And October, okay, but I love November. I love those gray days. And that last line just hit me so much because some people see that, you know, it's the death of things. No, no. I see eternity there. It was wonderful.
It's interesting because Christmas is barely in winter.
Right.
I think sometimes we lose sight of how long autumn feels like it lasts. And when autumn really kicks in, because you can have summer-esque days in October. In November, when
right.
we're not in November, we think of November as like, oh, it's so chilly. It's all, you know, it's really often not. Even in New England, it can be sweatshirt weather. You don't have to have the mittens on yet, and you're not necessarily seeing your breath at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You're often not. And that's when you're getting a lot of the colors. It might not be prime season to leaf peep in Vermont, but somebody like John Clare, who spent a lot of his life hauling ass through woods, was not really so much into leaf peeping as seeing bird's nests and seeing the adjustments that nature made for the coming of winter. And he could capture that like a Thoreau could capture it in America, but more pithily. That's an intense, intensely colored poem.
A wonderful sampler of autumnal art from Colin Fleming this afternoon on Downtown. Colin, we thank you as always, and we'll do it again next week.
Okay, sounds good, sir.
Colin Fleming, Tuesdays here on Downtown. Visit his website at colinflemminglit.com and look at all the wonderful things he's put together for you there.